Hey, everybody, welcome into another episode of Toeing the Slab, Pitching with David Cone, where we discuss pitching and other offseason topics, some deeper topics this episode as well. We do it with the five-time World Series champ, the Cy Young Award winner, David Cone, the ace of research, James Smythe, myself, Justin Shackle, and our wonderful producer, Dan Work, is with us as well. It's been a while, guys. I know, James, you were in Portugal, a nice European vacation here, and we're recording this near the tail end of awards week. I don't think we've gotten any surprises, guys. This is pretty much gone as we expected, right?
No, I think so. Yeah, I mean, the writing was on the wall. We knew Gerrit Cole was the front runner for a long time, really, the last 6 weeks of the season. It was just a matter of him finishing strongly and on a good note. And National League side, maybe a little more up in the air, but Blake Snell, obviously a two-time winner now. That's a big deal. To win one Cy Young is a big deal, but to be a multiple Cy Young Award winner, that's a different level.
Right. And for Cole, it was kind of a matter of time. A lot of the awards have been pretty much the chalk favorite selections, the rookies, the managers, the size. And Coney, you mentioned Blake Snell. Not only is he the 22nd pitcher to win two Cy Youngs, he's the seventh to win in the American League and in the National League. The other six, Gaylord Perry, Pedro Martinez, Randy Johnson, Roger Clemens, Roy Halladay, and Max Scherzer. So some good company there.
Yeah, we're going to discuss Blake Snell, Gerrit Cole, kind of dig a little bit deeper with what these Cy Young Awards mean for each. Snell's obviously a free agent here this offseason. We're going to discuss Shohei Ohtani. There's some news about what he could possibly do as a maybe an alternative to a long-term big money deal. We'll take a look at some undervalued free agent pitchers, some teams that may be lying in the weeds here, poised for a big move. We saw a report from Jeff Passan about possible changes to the pitch clock after just 1 year. We'll discuss that. And then we'll get into some Yankees talk, obviously. Brian Cashman's comments about Giancarlo Stanton catching a lot of eyes and ears. And also try and discuss and dissect what the hiring of James Rausen could mean for the Yankees hitting approach overall. Also, right before we're about to record, we see the news about the A's getting unanimous, or check that. I don't know if it's unanimous support from MLB owners, but they get enough votes to put the move in place to move to Las Vegas. So we'll touch on that as well. Lots to do here. James is back in New York. David, I believe you're at your abode in Florida, correct?
Yeah, I'm down in Florida. Yes.
Okay.
Got a lot of rain, a lot of wind down here.
Nice. I'm in a hotel room in Los Angeles with some faulty Wi-Fi, so apologies in advance here for the sound quality. We're making it work, though, through awards week. And David, like always, starts us off with the opener. What do you have for us this week?
Well, yeah, I never get tired of watching the reactions on when these awards are announced, in particular the Cy Young Award. And there's always a backstory. So, you know, it takes you back to Little League when your father took you out in the backyard and had a little catch. You want to have a catch, right? Back to Kevin Costner doing it in the movie, right? So, yeah, that always gets me. I remember, you know, when I won the Cy Young, I immediately gave the award to my father and the reaction that he had, because he was my coach. He was my first pitching coach. The reaction that my mom had, giving her a big hug. You know, we didn't have television cameras on us back in the mid-90s. So that's what makes me appreciate seeing these reactions live of these guys as it is announced. Gerrit Cole was kind of heartwarming for me. You see his father, his mother, his wife right next to him. So to me, that's a big deal. You know, that really goes to the heart of baseball. And the father and son, the mothers and sons, the mothers and daughters, anybody who's part of this game, who has played it at any level, understands that feeling that you get from sort of parental pride, I guess you'd say. So that always gets me. Ed Cone had my Cy Young Award until he passed away. And he hung it right on his den where he looked at it every night watching a baseball game on TV.
That's awesome. And so as far as the announcement goes, Coney, so what was it back then? You just get a phone call from the BBWAA and say, hey, Coney, you won it.
That's exactly the way it was. Jack O'Connor, the great Jack O'Connor, gave me a call and, you know, and told me the news. That's the way it was done. Jack's great. You know, Jack's been doing that for so long. He was a personal friend, actually, because he'd cover, you know, I'd seen him around New York so many years, both on the Mets and Yankee side of town. So getting a call from a familiar voice back then was nice, but I really appreciate seeing the emotional reaction of the families, especially the parents.
I don't know if I ever looked into this, David. How many first place votes did you get? Do you know right off the top of your head?
I don't. You know,
Okay.
my Cy Young is obviously an asterisk Cy Young because it was
Yay.
an abbreviated season in 1995. It was the strike year. And
Bullshit.
Jimmy Key finished second. So yeah, I mean, it was, yeah, the baseball writers decided to go ahead and give out awards that year because it was the season ended on August the 12th. And I remember going on back then, it was Mike and the Mad Dog, and Mike Francesa told me to throw the award in the trash. Said it's meaningless. You throw that award in the trash. And I said, well, Mike, I can't. I already gave it to my dad. And silence, silence. This was on FAN at the time. Just silence on that end. And then he changed the subject and went on to another one.
Francesa always with a delicate touch. In
Yes.
that 94 Cy Young vote, Coney beat out Jimmy Key 108 to 96 in points. The first place split was 15 votes for David and 10 for Key. The other three votes, two went to Randy Johnson, one went to Mike Messina, and they finished third and fourth in the vote. Lee Smith rounding out the top five there as a closer. And so yeah, it's a pretty close vote, but come on, Cody, there's no asterisk there. This wasn't a
No.
60 game season, is it?
Yeah.
It's a two more than 2/3 of a season.
It was, but it was very controversial at the time. And the Baseball Writers Association got together and decided on their own. It was up to them whether to give out awards that year or not. And they wanted to retain the continuity of the award and the history of the award. And so there you go. That's how I got it.
You know, David, I'm glad you brought up Mike Francesa because I think for people of a certain age, obviously you grew up with Mike and the Mad Dog in the New York City area, and I'm definitely influenced from their Hall of Fame perspective from Francesa and Chris Russo. And the number that always is like drilled into my head now, and you can't tell me otherwise, is that to kind of consider a player for worthiness for Cooperstown, they have to have like seven Hall of Fame seasons on their resume. The number is seven for me. And you could just look at their resume and see, hey, do they stack up? You're looking for those, for at least for me, I look for those seven seasons off the bat, and then I do more digging here. So, with that, how many more elite seasons do you think Gerrit Cole needs to cement himself as a Hall of Famer?
Well, he certainly has the base already in place. I mean, a lot of the yeoman's work has already been done by him. And this really helps just to sort of have that Cy Young under his belt. He may win more as we move forward. It depends. I it's much more an argument of quality over quantity. You know, the classic Sandy Koufax argument, the five greatest seasons of all time or belong to Sandy Koufax. And you know, he didn't have the longevity because of the arm injury. And then you think of somebody on the other end that hung around forever. Maybe it was Gaylord Perry, who pitched so long and so deep that the quantity of his numbers added up to something that you just couldn't ignore anymore. So, yeah, Jay Jaffe is a friend of mine. I think he does a great job with his sort of Jaws metric on. You know, the peak value, measuring the peak of someone's career versus the overall quantity of it. You can slice it and dice it any way you want, but it's still going to come down to quality over quantity. And if you have, let's say, if you have four or five unbelievable years, Pedro Martinez type years, Dwight Gooden back in 1985 type years, yeah, that might be enough, right? If the quality is that good, you might have a guy that doesn't need to have the quantity on his side or seven great Hall of Fame years.
Well, he has the peak part down already, right, guys? He's 30. He just finished his age 32 season. He checked off the Cy Young box. He's been either the best or one of the best starting pitchers in the game for the last 6 or 7 years now. He does not seem to be having any signs of slowing down. He has that peak part down. A lot of times, Hall of Fame cases are made in the weaker parts of a player's career. Even if they start to tail off, do they stick around long enough to hit various counting stat benchmarks? Well, Cole has 145 wins. Is he going to be the next guy to hit 200? And what are starting pitcher standards going to be looking like in the next 5 to 10 years? Is Cole going to end up being one of the last guys to vault over 200 wins? And, you know, war is another thing that a lot of people look at these days when judging pitchers. And Cole is off to a really great start. He's at 40 war through age 32. And a good Hall of Fame benchmark to start the conversation is like, 50, 60 is usually a lock. Coney's around 60, by the way. And so if you look at guys to hit 40 career war through age 32, it's a bit of a mixed bag. You know, Clayton Kershaw, slam dunk. Max Scherzer, slam dunk. But then there's guys that didn't age well or just came up a little short. Guys like a Felix Hernandez or a John Lester. So we're going to find out more about his case. Even if he's out of his peak in his early 30s, does he pitch well into his mid 30s and late 30s and kind of rack up some counting stats to pad the numbers there?
One thing about Gerrit Cole, and I know James and I, we've talked about it, and Justin as well. Historically speaking, in the top five are one of the greatest power and control pitchers. When you look at his strikeout to walk ratio, off the charts, historical in nature, in terms of comparatively any other pitcher in the history of the game. And, you know, and you could sort of factor in the environment or the era he pitched in, and more strikeouts in his era now. But it's undeniable his combination of control and power is elite, and maybe in the top five of all time in the history of the game.
And that's a great point with his, you know, with the control factor too. Look, he's a pitcher just like anyone else. The end can come around the corner at any moment. And it's, you know, you have the sword of Damocles hanging over any pitcher at all times, which is sounded really too grim, but
reality.
It's true. Now, Granted, Cole seems like the kind of guy who, even if he starts to lose velocity as he ages, his pitchability is off the charts too. So he seems like someone who would very easily, much more easily transition into a crafty veteran sort of game, going from the flamethrower to the pitchability mode there.
That's one of the things that stands out to me about Gerrit. He is consistently ahead of the curve. So I have confidence in him in terms of trends. And I guess if you can try and forecast a pitcher's latter peak years and then near the twilight of his career, I have the confidence that he's going to still stay ahead of the curve with whatever trends or where the pitching industry is later on. And another number that I'm kind of not focused on, but paying attention to with Gerrit later on, the overall strikeout numbers. I mean, he had 2,000 strikeouts. He eclipsed that this year. Does he get 3,000 strikeouts? Could he get 3,500? Inch closer to 4,000. So those are the things to watch out for. If you are keeping count the way I do it in that, you know, the Mike and the Mad Dog scale, for me, already 5 Hall of Fame seasons for Gerrit Cole. So only 2 more needed to hit that 7-season threshold. People, back to toeing the slab in a moment, but I need to remind you, as we gear up for these winter months with frigid cold temperatures, there is action on the field that is going to keep everything hot in the streets. That is with DraftKings. And we've teamed up with DraftKings, which is an official partner of the NFL, to get you closer to that hot action. Right now, new customers who bet just $5 will get $150 in bonus bets instantly. So download the DraftKings app now. Use promo code SLAB. If you're a fan of multiple teams, you want to bet on all of them at once, combine multiple bets together for a shot at an even bigger payout. And if sports betting's not yet available in your state, not to worry. You can still join in on all the fun with DraftKings Daily Fantasy Sports. Download the DraftKings Sportsbook app now. New customers, use promo code SLAB. Bet just $5 on any wager. You get $150 in bonus bets instantly. That's promo code SLAB, S-L-A-B, only at DraftKings Sportsbook. David mentioned Gaylord Perry's name a few moments ago, and something just jumped out at me last night on social media with the Cy Young announcements, because Gaylord Perry spent time with the Padres. Feels like he spent time with half the league, but with Blake Snell winning the Cy Young, they had Gaylord's picture there. Gaylord Perry looks like, in that picture, and it was when he was playing, he looked like he would be the oldest manager in Major League Baseball today if you brought that picture back. But transition here to Blake Snell. Does this add anything extra to Blake Snell's free agency, winning a second Cy Young Award?
Well, from a marketing standpoint, it certainly does. If you sign Blake Snell, you're signing the reigning NL Cy Young Award winner. So yes, I mean the PR departments can certainly play with that. What that does to his contract status, trying to project moving forward what he's worth. Yeah, I'm not sure that's going to add all that much. Although it doesn't hurt, obviously, for a massive understatement. I think the thing with Blake Snell is that he's always had tremendous stuff, sort of that gravity-defying four-seam fastball, sort of the yellow hammer curveball, good changeup. The question with Blake Snell has always been command. When you compare and contrast him to Gerrit Cole, we just mentioned what kind of command Gerrit Cole has. That's probably why he's on the way to the Hall of Fame. Blake Snell's control is probably a reason why he's not. And that's probably why he hasn't been able to get deeper into games, because his stuff is so good, he has a hard time kind of finding the strike zone at times. But nonetheless, the quality of his numbers are undeniable. His stuff is undeniable. He's left-handed. And yes, I think it does. Everything helps him. To answer your question, Shaq, yeah, it certainly does help on the margins. But with Blake Snell, I think you kind of know what you're getting there. A lefty with exceptional stuff that also probably has trouble with the radar at times, and is not going to be a guy that's going to get you deep in the games a lot of times either.
Well, I think it helps in that this season he was healthy and he's had a lot of issues staying healthy, providing enough innings that you want out of a quote unquote ace. And real quick, Shaq, you mentioned Gaylord Perry. He was 39 in that Cy Young season with the Padres. And yes, if you
He
saw
looks
any of the
69.
graphics, he looks like the grandfather of the pitching staff. And interestingly, this is not the first time that a Yankee and a Padre were Cy Young buddies in the same year. In 1978, it was Perry with the Padres and Ron Guidry, of course, winning with the Yankees. But with Snell, I thought this was very interesting, this Cy Young race. Snell ended up winning pretty easily, but it is that classic quality versus quantity. I love Logan Webb. If you asked me, who do you want to be the ace of your staff next year, the next 3 years, the next 5 years, I'd pick Logan Webb. I find the innings to be very valuable, but at the end of the day, Webb had 36 more innings than Snell, but he also allowed 36 more runs. So you don't need to be a mathematician to know that that's like a 9 ERA over those extra innings. So yes, the value is there out of Logan Webb, but the ERA, too much to ignore. A full run difference for Snell this year, 225 versus 325 for Webb. And even though Snell led the league in walks, first Cy Young winner to lead the league in walks since early Wynn in 1959, but I just think that the 2.25 ERA towering over the league and his closing push, guys, Snell's last 23 starts. So from late May until the end of the season, Snell had a 1.20 ERA. And you kept waiting for, oh, does Spencer Strider, Zach Gallen, Webb, Justin Steele, does somebody jump up and take it? But Snell just got better as the year went along. And even though it's a little bit, if I was a voter, it'd be a little bit of hold my nose and check off the guy who had the highest walk rate and fewer innings, but the run prevention was there for Snell, so hats off to him.
Yeah, I'm with you, James. Some of those numbers would have held me up on Snell, but that's essentially his season right there, because he had a 5+ ERA right around the time in May when he just started pitching out of this world. So that chunk from May all the way through the end of the season, that's essentially what won Blake Snell this Cy Young Award. That in and of itself is pretty impressive, because you're basically shaving 2 months off a pitcher's season, and he still does enough to win a Cy Young Award. So hats off to Blake Snell. Does it add anything extra to his free agent value? Definitely doesn't take anything away. So it'll be interesting to watch with what Blake Snell is able to receive on the open market. Shohei Ohtani is on the open market. Shohei Ohtani is also going to be likely winning the AL MVP. The awards are going to be announced later today. We're recording this episode early in the morning. But there was one report that you may have missed. It was from Alden Gonzalez, where he reported that Ohtani could potentially be open to a short-term large AAV contract. Do you believe that could happen? And should it happen with Ohtani?
I love this question. It's something that on a smaller scale I did at the end of my career, with the Yankees. I did sort of the last three or so years, maybe even 4 years, I did sort of a series of 1 year contracts, and it paid off for me. A lot of it was based around my arm and whether I was going to hold up or not. So George Steinbrenner at the time didn't want to go to 2 or 3 year deals at the end of my career. So I said, fine, let's go year to year. And I ended up making more money that way because I kept coming through up until the end where I kind of face planted in my last year. I love this idea for Ohtani. Ohtani's got leverage. He's in a unique spot. I was talking to Mark Gubaza this year, who covers the Angels, a longtime player and great broadcaster.
Friend
He
of the
said
show.
that, friend of the show,
Yeah.
absolutely. He said that Ohtani was making somewhere in supposedly, reportedly, somewhere in the neighborhood of $70 million off the field in endorsements. That puts him in a unique leverage spot where he can play this game. You know what? I don't want to sign one of those 13-year deals to where I get where I'm in one place and at the end of my career, some of these guys kind of feel stuck. And they may, where you just kind of have to play it out, or the organizations get stuck at the back end of deals. Why not? Why not shoot for the moon? Why doesn't he just push the average annual value up? See where he lands, see how he comes back from his second Tommy John surgery, see how well he plays, see if he likes playing where he chooses to go. And if it's not Anaheim, obviously. So I love this idea. Yes, if I'm him, I'm thinking that's not a bad way to go. 3 year deal somewhere with high average annual value, and then go from there. Anybody can do it. He can do it because you get the feeling that his baseball money, he's not going to be sort of prone to sort of say, I'm going to take the longest, most money deal right now. This is my only shot. Ohtani's a unique talent. He may have multiple shots at this before he's done playing.
Could it happen? Yes. I'm in wait and see, believe it when I see it mode, because you see this rumor around guys every now and then, and it never really happens. You usually see guys take a long-term deal, take the most money, don't leave money on the table. But Ohtani is a unique talent, and Coney, you laid out perfectly that this is a pretty unique situation. Also his injury, so you could even have a shorter-term deal with an opt-out tied around when he gets back to pitching. So I think this is a fascinating question, and I think it really could happen. And the other thing too is he wants to be on a winning team. And if he opens himself up to taking a shorter deal for more money per year, I think that also really opens up the potential suitors. There are a lot more teams that would jump into the pool knowing that we're not going to have to make a 10 or 12 year commitment.
Any chance that this is kind of an idea that's coming off of what teams may be telling him, or is he on his own with this potential idea?
You kind of get the feeling that he's on his own. He plays it so close to the vest. Nobody knows anything. Even the people that were around him every day in Anaheim, really, you just don't know. He's on his own program. He's completely in charge of what his routines are, his hitting routine. He rarely takes batting practice on the field, his pitching routine, what he goes through in between starts to get himself prepped and ready to play. Phil Nevin told me last year that this guy wakes up in the morning thinking from the minute he wakes up, charting his day exactly how he's going to become the best baseball player in the world, best baseball player in the history of the world. I mean, the minute he wakes up in the morning, that's what he's thinking. And how am I going to set my day structurally to be able to accomplish that goal? That's how dedicated this guy is. That's how close to the vest he plays it. That's how much on his own program he is. So, when you think about Shohei Ohtani, he clearly thinks outside of the box and he does his own thing and to great success. So that's what Phil said. Okay, I've heard enough. You do your own thing. I got it. I got it. He even told a story about Ohtani when he was pitching on Patriots Day in Boston. It was an 11 o'clock start that Ohtani went to Nevin and said, "You know what? I'm going to go to bed an hour a day earlier, an hour a night earlier, and then I'm going to catch up." He's got his hours of sleep tracked so that he can make up for the extra 2 hours for an 11 a.m. start on Patriot Day in Boston.
I love that. More sleep is always good.
Yeah.
Now that's the meticulous nature that you'd want if you're a team who is about to back up the truck, potentially, whether it's short term or long term. Ohtani's definitely going to get paid. I think the contract, either which way he goes, is going to potentially be unprecedented. I guess a related topic here, because there is so much mystery around what Shohei Ohtani could do here. And there are whispers of, sleeper teams, but not just with Ohtani. Throughout free agency here, I'm kind of going off the beaten path with some of these list of questions that I sent you guys. Is there a team who you think not a lot of people are talking about that could be poised to make a massive splash, whether it be in free agency or via trade, but mostly with this free agent class? If there's one team, who do you have?
Well, I guess if you're going to narrow it down to one team, I always think about Toronto. They are a massive market. Their television ratings are through the roof. We never hear a lot about it because it's Toronto. They're in Canada. We don't see a lot of Toronto Blue Jays on national TV because the ratings don't count for ESPN or Fox or some of the national broadcast. But believe me, they are a giant. They have tremendous resources. They're going to finish the renovation of their stadium in the lower half of Rogers Center up there. They did a beautiful job so far. They're going to finish it off. That owner, Mr. Rogers, they have unlimited resources. They would be in on Ohtani if they could be. So, if Shohei Ohtani had any interest in going to Toronto, Toronto would make that splash. And the problem with Toronto is they almost have to overpay some guys to go to Canada sometimes, whether it's tax related or lifestyle related, which I never really understood. It's a beautiful place to play. It's a beautiful city. I enjoyed my time there. When I think of one organization or one team or a sleeping giant that has tremendous resources, it's always the Toronto Blue Jays.
I was waiting for that phrase, sleeping giant. And I know you love Toronto. And I think of the Mariners, although I think, Coney, that they might be both the Blue Jays and the Mariners. Are they a little too are they not underrated enough for this question? I don't know, Shaq, because and I see the Mariners, they're poised to just take that next step. They have a great rotation. They just seem a couple pieces here, a couple pieces there away. Their payroll committed for next season is $139 million. So it seems like there's room to grow there. And I don't know. I'm just taking a shot in the dark here because, hey, 2 years ago at this time, was anyone thinking of the Texas Rangers as a team that could really make a splash? And I know they're not a big market team, but maybe the Detroit Tigers, they're going into the next phase of their rebuild. Maybe they only have $79 million committed to their payroll for next season. And the AL Central is going to be there for the taking over the next few years because the Twins are already talking about scaling things back. So maybe that's something where, the Tigers thinking, hey, maybe we can strike in the next year or two, and then they could be part of the next good Tigers team.
I think those are all good examples. I'm with you on Toronto and the perceived stigma about Toronto, David. It's one of my favorite cities to visit during the season, and I was going to pick them. I think the Blue Jays had probably the most disappointing October of all postseason teams. They have to do something here. They have some of their big franchise players due up in free agency in a short while, but I think if it all makes sense, like, they could be poised, whether it is an Ohtani, Yamamoto. They're always looking for lefty bats, it seems. Maybe Cody Bellinger makes sense there. I think they are poised to do something big. But for the sake of variety here, I'm going to throw out another team, and I think the Atlanta Braves, specifically when it comes to Ohtani and his willingness to maybe go to a place like Atlanta, I think they are right in the mix then, especially if these short-term rumors are true. If you could sign a short-term deal, if you're Ohtani, why not go to the team that finished with the best record in baseball last year? I think they've set themselves up. You talk about how well they've managed things financially with their homegrown core, some other players locking up to long-term extensions as well. It's all manageable there. I think the Braves put themselves in a position where you can talk about whether it is a short-term or long-term deal, specifically with a guy like Ohtani. I think they're right in the mix. It all comes down to whether or not Shohei Ohtani and Atlanta, Georgia are a good mix. Plus, the Braves have that Warren Buffett money now. So I would just not discount them from doing anything splashy or wild this offseason. They usually stay internal, right? I think they are poised to bring in an external piece this offseason.
Quite possible. That's a great point. Even though they probably are looking more at pitching right now than what would be essentially offense, at least for the first year until Ohtani's healed and can be able to pitch off a mound again. So yeah, that's going to be interesting. I kind of see Blake Snell as a good fit down in Atlanta too. So it's going to be interesting to see if the Braves try to rebuild their pitching staff, because it feels like, even though most people think that postseason's a crapshoot, and the Braves were unbelievably productive offensively last year, historically speaking, unreal the offensive production they had last year. But it really still comes down to, if you're in a crapshoot, do you have a shutdown starter? Do you have somebody, even if it's only 5 innings, like a Blake Snell or somebody like that? If it was Spencer Strider, even, he needs some help. So they really needed the kind of a power Miss Bats shutdown starter if you want to beat the crapshoot of postseason.
That's a good fit. And the Braves, you know, them being a publicly owned company, we get to see a little bit more under the hood than we would for another team. Rob Maines of Baseball Prospectus has been doing a series looking at their finances as it comes out, and they are rolling in the dough. So they do have money to burn. And it goes to show how profitable owning a big league ball club can be. So there's room for them to operate.
All right, let's go to the other end of the scale with free agency. Who is the most undervalued pitcher on the free agent market? Starter or reliever? Who is it in your eyes?
Well, yeah, sort of. There's a list of starters, obviously, that to me are interesting. Now, some of them are on the older end, but I'll give you a quick list of five, and then I'll give you my choice. And at the top is Luis Severino's everybody's favorite reclamation project. He's still throwing the ball in the upper 90s. Every organization or every pitching coach or pitching department thinks that they could fix him. They've got something that could help him. So I know there's going to be a lot of interest there in Severino. But a couple guys at the bottom. I mean, I'm Michael Wacha, Seth Lugo, and Kenta Maeda. I'm going to choose Maeda on the back end at 35 years old. I'm sure the price won't be that much, a 1 or 2 year deal, probably on the back end of the rotation, a 4 or 5 starter. Still had 117 Ks and 104 and a third inning. Still can miss bats. Still has an elite splitter. If you're looking for a five guy, number five starter, at minimal investment, probably, or a shorter end deal, I like Maeda. I like Kenta Maeda.
Good call. I'm going to go with Michael Wacha. We've talked about him before on the show, and I just think that, look, we're not in the ace part of the barrel here, right, guys? So if you're looking for a mid to back of the rotation guy, someone who you're not going to be able to bank on 33 starts like a Gerrit Cole, but he's made 23, 23, and 24 starts the last 3 seasons. And the last 2 years, a 3.32 ERA and a 3.22 ERA for the Red Sox and the Padres. Really solid, underrated, because he's only pitching 125, 130, 140 innings a year. But that's valuable. If they're good innings like that, that's valuable. I think you'll get great bang for your buck out of a guy like Michael Wacha, who's younger than you might think. He'll be going into his age 32 season, which is a little younger than I would have guessed before I looked this up. And you're right on Severino. I think he is more of a very much a dart throw reclamation project, as you said. And but the velocity and the shape and of his pitches and his command, it was all pretty much there. So it's not like he lost a ton of velocity and now he's, off in the woods as he goes into his 30s. I think, I don't know if it's going to be in New York, but I think Luis Severino does have a bounce back somewhere.
I'm with you. I'm liking Michael Wacha. I like Seth Lugo. I know David mentioned him. I'm going to the bullpen, and I'm going to go with right-hander Robert Stevenson, because saw him up close with the Rays last year. He was traded to Tampa Bay, and the Rays uncovered what seems like a lot of talent with Robert Stevenson. Threw near 100, near triple digits. His cutter was very impressive. Looking at some numbers here, 60 strikeouts, 8 walks in 42 games after being traded to the Rays. So, look, Tampa Bay uncovers some gems. We know that, especially in the bullpen. If Robert Stevenson can kind of bottle up what he learned in Tampa Bay, take it with him, I think he scores a multi-year deal and becomes a big piece in someone's bullpen. So if you're looking for relief help, I think Robert Stevenson is a guy you pay close attention to here.
Great, great call right there. And if you think last year at this time, if we would have had this question, who would have picked Zach Eflin, right, as the breakout star? He ended up I think a 3.5 baseball reference WAR, 3.5. So yeah, what a great sign. So who's going to be this year's guy? Who's going to be that guy for this year?
Well, we don't know who it is, but I love
Yeah,
the Robert
they
Stevenson
are.
pick. And thank you for going to the bullpen, Shaq, because we want to show some love to the relievers too. And look, if the Rays come calling for somebody, Lay, look out for that guy.
Yeah, I feel like we slight the bullpen often. We talk about starting pitchers way more than relievers. We got to start showing some more love to relievers here. All right. Big topic coming out of, obviously, for the entire 2023 season was the pitch clock. And now we are learning that the competition committee with Major League Baseball has proposed reducing the pitch clock by 2 seconds. So they want to go from 20 seconds to 18 seconds with runners on base. And Jeff Passan says that could possibly go into play as soon as next season. So going from 20 to 18 with runners on base, is that a big deal or not for pitchers?
Well, it can be. You know, I think the cat and mouse game really was underrated last year. You know, I'll give you an example. If you have 20 seconds on the clock, pitcher's already got his sign. He's on the mound, ready to throw the ball. The batter already steps in the box. So the clock starts ticking down. Now you're at 18, 17, 16. You have a base runner on first base. That allows the pitcher to hold the ball for an extended period of time. You could sit there for 12 seconds just holding the ball to try to freeze the base runner and freeze the hitter. The hitter might have already used his one time out at that particular point. So there, that creates sort of that lag time in there for a pitcher to kind of freeze a base runner and a hitter. That's why I always was sort of interested in why the hitters would get in the box too quickly. You have to be aware of the clock. And if you know that a pitcher is going to hold the ball or is going to use that to his advantage, then you shouldn't step into the box until 12, 11, 10 seconds, because your cutoff point is 8 seconds. So a lot of hitters aren't aware of that. They don't have that awareness. They don't want to think about it. I just want to get in the box and focus on something else. So this would eliminate a little bit, 2 seconds of lag time. It's going to help the base runners. It's designed for more action, designed to get the more base stealing, to disallow the pitcher from holding the ball for even if it's an extra 2 seconds, just to kind of speed up the pace a little bit on that cat and mouse game that I saw a lot of last year. Some hitters took advantage of it. Some pitchers did. Some hitters and some pitchers weren't even aware of it.
Well, I think the pitch clock was a big success this year. 15 with the bases empty, 20 with runners on. If they go to 18 with runners on, I don't think it would be that big of a deal, because most of the time the pitchers weren't running the clock all the way down. The batters were ready to go too. So it's not like we were always getting, you know, this 3-2-1 and then throw the ball. So now he's going to be even further under the crunch there. I think that, you know, maybe similar to spring training this year, where they'll be some griping or some confusion or whatever, and then things move along and it'll be like it never happened. So for now, I think it's not that big a deal, although I am a little concerned in that MLB has the ability to do this unilaterally. I think it would be best to at least get input from the players before hammering this through.
Yeah, I think it'd be important to hear the players' perspective after this one season. Let them. And I think it is a little too short of a sample too. I don't know if it's in the best interest to just automatically do it for next season. Let the current rules maybe breathe for another year or two, and then maybe trim it by 2 seconds or so. But you're right. It very rarely this season was I, you know, either calling games or watching a game where I paid close attention to the pitch clock winding down 3-2-1. That rarely happened. I mean, in totality, it had to be less than 1% of the time. Only a few instances where I was really focused on the pitch clock and a pitcher running down with guys on base. So something to watch out for. Could happen in 2024. I think it should maybe happen down the road. Last week, very interesting in Yankee land. Kind of the content we were all looking for the 40-plus days between the end of the Yankee season and from when Hal Steinbrenner and Brian Cashman actually spoke. So we start our Yankee chat here this episode with Brian Cashman, with some of the comments that he made at the GM meetings. Before we dive into this, let me just say, Brian Cashman is a very smart dude, and I do not think he does anything off the cuff. I think everything is by design. So with that being said, when it comes to his comments with Giancarlo Stanton specifically, what do we think the end game is with Brian Cashman's candor toward those Giancarlo Stanton comments?
I think, you know, Brian Cashman is just really kind of open and honest. That's kind of how he's been his whole career. He's one of the guys that will speak extemporaneously a lot when he deals with the media on a formal basis. It just sounds like Brian Cashman needs a Festivus day, right? He needs a kind of that day where you could, you know, the Seinfeld reference, obviously, a day for him just to get it all out. And it, obviously, you could tell that, you know, he needed to get that off his chest. There's a lot of criticism coming the Yankees' way, a lot of it justified, a lot of it unjustified, and certainly directed at Cashman himself. And I understand that there's a bit of a culture war in terms of, you know, James and I have talked about this. Analytics are ruining the game as the boogeyman. And it's such an easy and lazy thing to throw out there. And it's just so far from the truth. Every organization has an analytics department. It's really what you do with that information and how you get that information disseminated to your players and in what way you do that. And I think that seriously is the question. Joe Maddon, when he was fired from the Angels earlier this year, talked about how he loves information. He loves his analytics department, but he doesn't want them in the dugout. He doesn't want them in the clubhouse. He wants the major league coaches to handle that information and filter it and disseminate it to the players. And herein lies the problem in terms of the culture of how we deal with this new information that every organization has, every organization uses. Analytics are not ruining the game. In a lot of sense, they're helping a lot of players get a lot better. The question becomes is mixed messaging. Do you have an analyst that's 21 years old, straight out of college with an iPad going directly to players in between innings, on the bench, in the clubhouse during batting practice? Is that the right protocol? Is that the right way to go about it? And then you have somebody like a Sean Casey or an ex-player who's your hitting coach giving mixed messages to your players. And that's really the key here. It's not about the information or the analytics department. It's about how you get that information disseminated, interpreted to the players, and who's the voice, who's filtering. The Braves have really kind of shown the way to do it. Walt Weiss is that guy on the Braves. The Atlanta Braves have all ex-players that are coaches. They have a very abundant analytics staff, but they're not on the field before the game. They're not playing catch. They're not hanging around the batting cage. And if they are, it's very limited. They're certainly not on the bench during the game. So that's really the question. What style do you want? Do you want your analyst to have direct access to the players, or do you want a coach as a filter in between that can interpret that data and then deliver it to the players in their own language? That's really the key, what's going on across Major League Baseball, not just with the Yankees. This is happening everywhere.
Right, and that's why it's kind of silly to pose this, you know, us versus them kind of thing, because you talk about what works for the Braves. Well, the Rays have Jonathan Ehrlichman, a.k.a. Jay Money, who is an analytics coach, who is an analytics person in the dugout with Kevin Cash. So, and that seems to be working for them great. So some people do it this way, some people do it that way, and you either win or lose based on the talent you have anyway. So all these things are on the margins. As far as what Cashman said about Stanton, I was away during this week, but I did see on social media some of the comments that were being made. And I know fans were in the press were really taken aback, or it was a great controversy. I didn't really think much of it. Like you said, Coney, Cashman is pretty candid, just whatever's on his mind. And just the crux of the statement, he's acknowledging Stanton's lengthy injury history, and that's getting worse as he gets older, which is understandable. And it just seemed like a pretty matter of fact kind of thing. And I tell you what, I don't know Giancarlo Stanton. I highly doubt he's taking these comments personally. Apparently his agent did. And even then, look, general managers, owners, agents, they kind of have these little squabbles. It's kind of part of the job that they're on opposite sides here. So I don't really think much of it.
It's a great point. Maybe he could have chosen his words a little differently and it wouldn't have had the same impact, but within the context of what he was saying, he also said Giancarlo's a great hitter. He also praised him at the end of whatever he was trying to say there. Now, was it inartful for him to say, well, it's part of his game? Well, how about if he said, you know what, we need to protect ourselves in the event that he does get hurt again, so we need a little more depth on our bench. We love it when he's playing. He's a great hitter, but we have to protect ourselves in the event that he does get hurt. Would that sound better? It's kind of the same sentiment. So we're really kind of parsing words here.
Yeah, and it's all about getting him back to the Stanton that, you know, we know and love from years past, not 23. I mean, he was still an above average hitter in 2022, but getting him back to that game record type of guy. And if he only does that for 110 or 120 games instead of 150 games, that's fine too, as long as the quality is there and you can build around, hey, if we need to make up 40 games here or there, you know, at some point during the season, make it so you have better depth. But the important thing is getting him back on track at the plate and just kind of not worry too much about how many plate appearances he's going to get. Cause look, he has the injury history. He's going to be 34 next season. So, you know, you're not going to be able to bank on 600 plate appearances, right?
No, I'm with you. That one line is what I'm just hung up on, how to paraphrase Cashman saying that injuries are kind of part of Giancarlo's game. You could have, you know, potentially worded it differently and get the same meaning across and not have so much backlash about it. Other than that, I mean, what he said was pretty accurate. It's factually right. At the same time, I don't think anyone can question Giancarlo Stanton's desire to compete or go out and be great. So a little overblown in my eyes, that one half a sentence probably could have been worded a little bit better. And it's probably not as big of a topic as it's been made to be here this week or around the New York sports landscape. Yankees also made news. They brought in James Rowson as a new hitting coach. One of his first tasks, obviously, is trying to get Giancarlo on the right page. But overall, when you take a look at this hire, and I mean, people are trying to analyze every single move on the diamond now. What, you know, a bullpen coach hire means for a certain team, strength and conditioning. We are going deep in the weeds here, kind of, I think, treating it more like NFL coaching positions. At the same time here, James Rowson, just historically, he doesn't have that cookie cutter philosophy. He doesn't, I don't think, subscribe strictly to analytics, nor just that old school baseball feel and the eye test, you know, to kind of put it in a phrase there. It kind of sounds like he is open to it all, has an open mind, and isn't going to try and have a hitter be caught up in a cookie cutter format or approach at the plate. So with that being said, everything that we've heard in recent seasons, and especially in 2023, was that the Yankees pretty much subscribed uniformly to the launch angle approach. With James Rowson aboard here, guys, are the Yankees divorcing themselves from launch angle?
No, I don't think so. I think, you know, once again, we kind of get, you know, the launch angle is kind of another boogeyman term that we hear thrown about in baseball. Oh, everybody's trying to uppercut and hit the ball in the air. Well, you know, it's not so much that. It's about trying to drive the ball, that you can do more damage on balls that you hit with more authority on the sweet spot, you know, barreled up. Everybody wants to barrel up a baseball, and we know what that is. That's off the ground. We also know the ground balls hit at a higher exit velocity, you have a lower probability of getting a hit than if you can just get it over the infield and get it to outfield grass. How many times do you see a 60 to 70 mile an hour exit velocity that gets a little bit of a launch angle that gets over the infield that becomes a hit? 60 to 70 miles an hour on the ground is an out. It's death. So certainly, you know, that's not going to change. But I think the approach is, are we trying to do too much of a pulled fly ball approach? We see a lot of that in analytics today, and not so much the launch angle revolution, but that is where the rubber meets the road for me. Yeah, of course. If you can get pitches to pull and get in the air, yes, you're going to do damage. And I think the OPS on those is probably over 900, closer to 1,000 OPS if you can pull a fly ball in the air. But when you're trying to pull fly balls in the air on pitches that are down and away, in particular off-speed pitches, those become death. Do ground balls, that becomes out. So that, you know, there's sort of that balance between approach. What's this pitcher trying to do? Is this a night I can look to pull fly balls? Is this a guy that's prone to throwing breaking balls up in the zone? Maybe I can look to do that on a certain night. On another night, no. You know, Max Scherzer's pitching, or somebody that's really good at keeping the ball down and away, you know, that pulled fly ball approach isn't going to work. So you need them, sort of a multi-layered approach. Paul O'Neill talks about hitting the ball all over the field, driving the ball in the gap, that your timing is right. If you can hit a line drive up the middle or the other way in the gap, that sets your swing up to be able to pull off-speed pitches naturally instead of trying to pull the ball in the air. It happens naturally. That's an overall philosophy. Major league hitting coaches now have to navigate sort of a minefield of each individual personal hitting coach that a lot of these players have, including biomechanics, which you're going to get evaluated, a self-evaluation or sort of an efficiency evaluation of how well your body moves biomechanically. How do you tie all this in together with approach on a given night? Who's pitching? What kind of pitches are you going to face? Biomechanically, how's your body moving? How do we get you back to where you need to be? I mean, it's so multifaceted to say, you know, well, we're going to go away from the launch angle revolution. No, that's just oversimplified in my mind. It's much more extensive than that.
It is, and you laid it all out there, Coney. And as far as, you know, people lamenting exit velocity and all that, it's basically hitting the ball hard, which is a good thing. The highest exit velocities this year, the Braves, the Yankees, the Rangers, the Phillies. All right, so you have some great offenses. And then the Yankees, who up until this past season were in the same spot and did very well. So it was working then. It didn't work this year. They were hitting the ball on the ground more often. They were getting more of those weak outs. And it's not one size fits all. But Rousen, I think, is a good hire. He was a coordinator in the Yankee system in two different stints. He's bounced around a couple clubs, including with the Twins. The Twins had big offenses, 2017, 18, 19, including the most homer happy team in MLB history, the 2019 Twins. Rousen was at the helm for that, so it was working for them then. I think Rousen's hire is a good one. Aaron Judge on board, which, you know, I think a lot is too much is made of various hires, who the hitting coach is, who the pitching coach is at the big league level. A lot of these things are more on the margin. So if the players are on board and if he's speaking their language, I think it's a good thing.
Yeah, I think that right there, I think that falls in line with when you hear ownership say, hey, big changes are going to be happening, but you may not notice them. I think the philosophy of a James Rousen could be that big change that, again, to the fans' eyes is a marginal change, but within the clubhouse could be a big thing. I think launch angle, if it was the singular approach, well, it's not going to be the singular approach anymore. It's going to be part of the approach. I think what David said is super accurate, that Rousen's just going to have everything that you were talking about. That's, you know, the proverbial binder is going to be with James Rousen. He's going to bring all of that into the dugout and into the clubhouse each and every day. And I think that goes with everything I've heard about him and his experience, especially at the major league level over the last decade or so. Bottom line, he's bringing experience, big league experience, back to that dugout and into that position. Guys, before we get out of here, didn't get your thoughts on the whole A's to Vegas thing. Happened when it was reported right before we started recording this week that the A's received enough votes, ownership approval around Major League Baseball. They're going to be going from Oakland to Vegas. Are you both Vegas guys? I feel like people are, they either are or they aren't. Are you guys into Vegas personally? Not with the A's going to Vegas.
Love Las Vegas. Can't wait to go to a concert and see the Spear. You know, I mean, that's an incredible venue, it looks like. So yeah, I mean, it's not about Vegas. It's about Oakland and the market that's getting left behind, and whether something, you know, whether something else could have been done there and what really happened. And the people on the inside are the only ones who really know what happened during those negotiations and what fell apart and why it fell apart. There's also territorial issues with regards to the San Francisco Giants. San Jose is a great market, very close, but that's own, you know, there was territorial issues with the Giants as well. So, you know, there's a lot of variables involved in this Oakland situation that's left behind. This really isn't about Vegas and how well they'll do as a major league franchise. I know the television market isn't that big. I know there's concerns on that end about the market size and what's going to happen there. But I think the real question is the tragedy that happened in Oakland and why it happened. And, you know, I'm not an expert. I'm not privy enough on the inside information to really speak to it all that well. But I can say this, it's disappointing. It's disappointing for the people of Oakland, for the history of the Oakland A's out there. And at one point, you know, such a proud franchise, such an overachieving franchise in the Billy Beane era. And even before that, going back to the colorful uniforms of Reggie Jackson and Joe Charlie Finley, really. And you know, the who doesn't remember Joe Rudy and Sal Bando and Reggie Jackson, Blue Moon Odom and Vida Blue? I mean, who doesn't remember those guys? I remember them fondly, you know. And it's just sad for me to see an end of an era in Oakland. I don't have answers as to whether Vegas is the right move or whether they'll work or not or the market in Vegas, but I'm sad for Oakland.
Damn, Coney, you got me emotional with that remembrance there, and it's a shame. And you know, John Fisher, good luck in Vegas, because they're one of the smallest they'll be one of the smallest markets in sports. And it's one thing if you're the Raiders and you have 8 or 9 games a year, you're going to have trouble in one of the smallest markets in the heat of the summer trying to get something going in Vegas. And also they're going to have this nomadic existence for 3 seasons until they start in 2028. So their lease runs out in 2024, and reportedly they'll be spending 3 seasons, maybe playing games at the Coliseum, maybe playing games in San Francisco, maybe playing games at their AAA ballpark in the suburbs of Las Vegas. And what happened to the A's? It wasn't just, oh, some mysterious thing that befell them. It was John Fisher. He killed baseball in Oakland, and he will forever be a villain to A's fans. And, you know, you see when Peter Seidler passed away this past week, how beloved he was by the Padres fans. And, you know, there's murals being put up of him this week in San Diego, which is kind of neat to see. And people talking about what a great guy he was in the community. And you contrast that with Fisher, who has none of that, and really just ripped the team out, ripped the rug out from under these fans. And the A's fans, you know, your heart goes out to them. And, you know, we Coney, you grew up with the Royals, and they had a successful run. Shaq, you know, we grew up with the Dynasty Yankees in the 90s. So the idea of like losing your team like that is a bit foreign. But I can't imagine being an A's fan or being a little kid who loves the A's, and then all of a sudden it's like, oh, well, now there's no more Oakland A's.
Yeah, I mean, David reeled off some of those names. I mean, the A's were a dynasty at one point, and there are only a handful of those teams over the last, you know, 60, 70 years that you could say were dynastic. And Oakland had one of them. So it is sad for Oakland. You feel for Oakland. I'm not defending John Fisher here. I think he has a lot of, obviously, a lot of errors on his hands here. But I can't just completely dismiss the city of Oakland either. This back and forth went on for nearly 2 decades. So it's really sad for the city and the people and the fans from Oakland. I will say this with Vegas. This is a completely new venture from what we saw with other professional sports teams. The NFL is at its own level. It's a behemoth. Like James said, the Raiders play 8 days out of the year in Las Vegas, 8 or 9 days. The Vegas Golden Knights, expansion team, brand new. This is going to be different from those 2 examples. Curious to see how it works. But in the meantime, yeah, they're going to be nomads, which is going to be even more interesting to watch here as we get to 2028. First year that the A's are scheduled to play in Vegas. But yeah, your heart goes out for the people of Oakland. Guys, good episode this week. Pleasure to talk to you. Thank you for those of you listening or watching the YouTube stream for bearing with us. We're kind of all over the place making this happen, but we wanted to get some Cy Young reaction and tackle some of the big topics going on in the sport right now. And we'll push out another episode before Thanksgiving, because feels like there's going to be some action heating up in the days ahead between now and next Thursday. So anything else you guys want to touch on before we get to the weekend? Any big plans? Anything before we sign off here?
No, just you said it well. Stay tuned, because if something happens, we'll react.
Beautiful. All right, for David, for James, for our great producer, Dan Work, I'm Justin Shackle. Thanks for listening to another episode of Toe on the Slab, Pitching with David Cone, a production of John Boy Media. Take care, everybody.